Well, thanks for having me. Fun to be here. Arlene was just asking, have you ever spoken in front of an all-women group? And I was thinking, I don't know if I ever have, other than coming to old MOPS meetings when I was younger, and or even not. That's right, not so long ago, I did do one Bible study. I am a pleaser, which makes me nervous this morning because I'm not sure how pleased you will be by the end of this time. Arlene asked me like 2 months ago, 3 months ago, to talk today. And she said, basically, you know, we're going to be at about Genesis 16 at the new year, where you're looking at, the birth of Ishmael and Isaac and the decision that Abraham and Sarah made to have Ishmael through Hagar and then, you know, what happens. And she said, will you just kind of give us a history of what has taken place as a result of that decision? I've got basically 4,000 years to cover. In what do I have, about 40 minutes ish, as long as I want? Okay, well that's about 100 years a minute. So that's what I'm going to try to do today. Just kind of give you the scope of what has taken place since then, even in up to current day. And obviously you all know the conflict that is taking place in the Middle East between Jewish and Arab people, and we all come with different assumptions of what caused that and how that connects with what happened in the Bible and all of that. So I'm going to kind of take you through a history of what's taken place since then. So I'm assuming this is going to feel very different from what Wednesday morning normally feels like. It's going to feel very different for me from what Sunday morning feels like. So again, I'm a pleaser. I'm afraid I might bore you or confuse you. So if you start getting bored, like raise your hand and I'll break into song. There's no guitar up here, but I'll try to do something. So I just want to provide, some of you have thought about this stuff, or some of you haven't thought anything about this. You will not think about it the minute you walk out this door. This will be the only time you think about it. But for some of you, you probably know more about this than I do. So I want to give you basic information. I also want to just challenge certain assumptions that we may have about this stuff and fill in some gaps for us. Before we start, my assumption growing up, I had almost no knowledge of this, and my assumption went something like this. This is the amount of information I knew was Abraham and Sarah got really impatient, and so they made this plan apart from God, and now look at the mess they've made in the world, okay? That's kind of what I knew, or that's what I assumed. It's about all I had. If you would ask me, what is the spiritual status of Ishmael and his line, I think I would have said something like, I'm not really sure, but I think he's kind of cursed or something like that, but I'm not really sure. That's probably when I was 10, that's what I would have assumed. So we're gonna kind of fill in some of those gaps. And I've realized in my own study of this over the last couple months, I've had to challenge both of those assumptions in different ways. And so I'll kind of fill you in on the way I process this. So here's what we're gonna do this morning. Here's our historical timeline, okay? This covers 4,000 years, 2000 BC to 2000 AD. We're going to cover four periods of history. First, we're going to look at the start of this thing, Isaac and Ishmael. I just want to review the lesson. Was that the last lesson you guys did in the... Okay, so we're going to look at Genesis again, just to kind of review the basic facts. Then, let's look at the rest of biblical history. What does the Bible actually say about Isaac and Ishmael and their lines? What doesn't it say? Then we'll look at the rest of history up to 1880. What happens in those 1800 years between Arabs and Jews? And then finally, we'll spend more time looking at the last 120 years where the crisis in the Middle East really has taken on a much more significant crisis, basically. So that's what we're going to do. So we'll start, let's start back where this whole thing began. So you're going to need your Bibles for this. I know you've already studied this, so I don't want to belabor it. But I want to look at the different passages in Genesis that talk about Isaac and Ishmael, beginning in chapter 16. Now just remember, chapters 12 through 15, you guys know this. Here's our map. We're going to be looking at this map a lot. God calls Abraham, right? Chapter 12. And he calls him from this region over here, and he says, I want you to leave your land and go to the land that I have promised you. And so Abraham leaves, he takes his nephew Lot, his wife Sarah, and some people, and they travel up this way, and then this is the promised land of Israel. This is where they kind of hang out, okay? We're going to look at this map a bunch. All right. So I want to ask two questions today of the Genesis stories. The first question is, who's at fault for what goes on here? Who's to blame for what takes place? And then the second is, what does God feel about this? What is his stance? Especially, what does God feel about Hagar and her son Ishmael, according to the biblical account? Okay? So those are the two questions. Who's at fault, and what does God think about this? All right, so I want to read the story again. You read it. You know, it's been a couple weeks, so you're probably a little rusty. So let's read this story again. So I'm going to do Genesis 16, verse 1. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant, an Egyptian slave that was her maidservant, named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abraham agreed to what Sarah said. Okay, so you've got this decision, and you talked about this a couple weeks ago, that Sarah makes, that to us sounds really tough, right? Here, I can't have kids, so here's my servant, sleep with her. Basically make her kind of a surrogate wife, and maybe you can have children through her, okay? Now, we look at this as a decision that was not based in faith, right? She failed to believe in God's promise. She was how old at this time? Like 90 years old. What is it? Or 70 years old. And it's clear that it's not happening. So she takes matters into her own hands, says, here's what we're going to do. You have to remember that this practice was a common practice in that day. Okay, I mean, we can't even picture doing that nowadays. But in that time, this was something you did. Maintaining the family line was the most important thing. I mean, it's about survival back then. This is not, you know, 2010. 2010, well, that's the first time I've said 2010. This is not 2010 Newport Beach, okay? This is 2000 BC, Middle East. So this is a very common practice. You have to keep the family line. And the other thing is God, throughout the previous chapters, he had promised Abraham a seed. He had actually never specifically said, through Sarah, I'm going to give you descendants. All he had said is, I'm going to give you a son. And so he hadn't actually specifically thought that. So Sarah thought, maybe this is God's way of doing this, okay? It's a very understandable thing to do, even though ultimately it was not what God wanted. It wasn't based on faith, but it was understandable. And obviously she's putting herself in a very vulnerable position, right? She's saying, here, husband, you take this woman, and she's gonna bear your kids. All right, so Abraham agreed, verse 3. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. Now, when Hagar knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress, Sarah. Okay, literally it says, Sarah became little in her eyes. So what happens is this: you've got this maidservant who's a slave, and now all of a sudden she becomes pregnant and her social status changes dramatically, right? All of a sudden she's the one carrying Abraham's child. She is like possibly the favored wife who's going to bring on the seed. And so she begins to look down on Sarah, and you know, she stops doing the dishes and she stops cleaning up after Sarah, and she, you know, she kind of is walking around, I'm going to be the mother of this man's children. So that's how she responds. Verse 5. Then Sarah says to Abraham, "You're responsible for the wrong I'm suffering." So she blames her husband. "I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." And Abraham doesn't really want to deal with this. So he says, "Your servant is in your hands. You do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarah mistreated Hagar. The word there is very strong. She abused Hagar. She really, really treated her harshly. So Hagar flees into the wilderness. So you've got this pregnant woman who is a slave and then is told to sleep with this guy, and once she does, she's kicked out of the place and she's fleeing in the wilderness. Okay, so our first question, whose fault is this? Sarah's? Sarah's, Hagar's? Everyone's? Okay, a little bit, you kind of feel some sympathy for both girls, right? Both are to blame in different ways. I mean, both at the end of the situation are not in happy places. Sarah has no son, Hagar is pregnant, and she's in the middle of the wilderness. Okay, that's not a good situation. You would know that better than I would. Okay, so second question is, what is the Lord's stance? What does he feel about it? Especially, what is his stance towards Hagar and her son? So let's look at what the Lord does. Verse 7, "The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert, It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress, Sarah. My mistress Sarah, she answered. The angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. The angel of the Lord also said to her, you are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. Ishmael means the Lord hears. For the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. That's the big verse right there. Verse 13. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me. For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram's son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Okay, so Hagar flees into the wilderness to escape persecution. How would you articulate God's posture towards her in this scene? What's his stance? How does he feel about her? Loving, caring, right? He basically comes to a woman who is in a dangerous place, in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, and comes to her at a spring, and says, I want you to go back to this really hard situation that you're in, where you've been mistreated. But he comforts her. He calls her by name. He finds her in a desert place alone, and he comforts her. And it's clear from in verse 13 that Sarah, that Hagar's been comforted by this, right? She says, the Lord has heard me, and I have a son who is now called the Lord hears, because he has seen and heard my affliction, and he's comforted me, he's protected me, and he's called me back to this place. So, big picture in this scene, you've got a God who's come alongside this powerless slave woman to comfort her and to encourage her back into it, what's going to be a difficult situation, okay? So that's the big picture. Now, the issue is, what do we do with verse 12? Because this is where we find, this is the prophecy that is played out throughout the rest of history. So here it is. Now it's clear, my thinking is, whatever is happening here, Hagar is comforted by this scene, isn't she? Right? I mean, God's going to convince her to go back to a hard place. He's needing to comfort her in order to do that. It would seem strange to me if everything he says about her son is a curse, because she clearly responds afterwards going, oh, the Lord has seen me. He's heard me. I mean, she's not responding as if, oh, your son's going to be cursed for the rest of your life, right? All right, so here it is. Three statements are made. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. Those are the first two. And the last one, he will live in hostility towards all his brothers. All right, so let's take these first two statements, okay? Two interpretations. One very unfavorable towards Ishmael, one more favorable, okay? And I'm going to let you kind of sit with these. The unfavorable one is this. He's basically, he's going to be a wild, stubborn man. He's going to be a jackass of a man, if I can say it that way. And he's going to be constantly getting into fights, okay? And that's a possibility. You can put a more favorable slant on it, which is to say, well, a lot of people are called by animal names in Old Testament, right? Wild donkey. So wild donkey is talking about this Bedouin, nomad existence that he's going to live in the desert, which is true of his descendants, the Arabs. And when it says his hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him, he's talking about he's going to be an independent man. He's going to struggle, and he's going to be this nomad who tries to find independence, and he's going to have the power to struggle against people to obtain that independence. And so the favorable towards Ishmael, at least, translation is that God is basically describing a son who is going to reverse the situation of his mom, okay? So mom is a slave. She is powerless to do anything. And God is saying, I'm going to give you a son, and he's going to be an independent spirit, and he is going to have the power to fight his battles against people as he wanders around in the wilderness. He will have that independence that you lack, okay? That's the favorable description, and scholars differ on the level of where they fall in the spectrum. Okay, and then here's the big one. the last statement, and he will live in hostility towards all his brothers, because brothers here is going to be Isaac and his descendants. Now, the key translation, again, favorable or unfavorable, it's this word right here. He will live in hostility towards all his brothers. Scholars don't know how to translate that. So I'm going to give you this. That what he says there is literally, he will live before the face of all his brothers, or he will live in the front or in front of his brothers. So who has a King James version here or a New King James? TP in the back, okay? King James reads, he shall dwell in the presence of all his brothers. NASB, who has an NASB? NASB reads, he will live to the east of all his brothers, which is where they settle in Arabia. New Living, any New Living translators here? Yeah? He will live in open hostility against all his relatives, so they go for the hostile. And then NIV, what I currently have, has this. He will live in hostility towards all his brothers with a footnote there that says, or live to the east of. Okay? So we've got some questions there, okay? Anybody else have a radically different translation? Yeah. Live at odds. Okay, so that's kind of a more subtle version of open hostility. Yeah, they live at odds. There's going to be conflict and tension. So hard to know exactly what to do with this. All right. So I want to just finish off the narrative in Genesis to see, again, what is God's stance towards Ishmael? What do we at least see in the rest of Genesis? So we've got some questions here that I'm not going to answer because I can't answer them, but things to consider. All right, so let's move on to Genesis 17. In Genesis 17, I guess that'll be next week for you guys, yeah? Probably? Close? So I won't say too much. God gives Abraham the covenant of circumcision. And this is where God finally promises offspring specifically through Sarah. So this is verse 15. God says to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Abraham fell face down. He laughed and said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abraham said to God, if only Ishmael might live under your blessing. So Ishmael's probably 10 at this time. You know, he's grown. He's fallen in love with his son. So let's just let him be the blessed one. Verse 19, then God said, yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year. Okay? So again, God saying, your firstborn son Ishmael, I will bless him. I will make him a great nation. But my covenant is going to be with Isaac. This is going to be the child of promise, not the child of natural descent. Okay? So let's just continue the story. Chapter 21, almost finished with the first section of history of 4,000 years. You're still with me, aren't you? Okay, good, because if you're not, we're in big trouble. All right. Having a tough time with these thin pages. Chapter 21. Is that what I said? Yeah. Okay, verse 8. So chapter 21, Isaac's born. Okay? And verse 8, the child Isaac grew and was weaned. And on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham was mocking. Okay, so there's this feast for Isaac, and apparently Ishmael is laughing at him, mocking, jesting. Hard to know exactly what's going on. And so Sarah says to Abraham, get rid of the slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. So basically Sarah sees Ishmael as a threat, and rightfully so. You know, this is a potential threat to the inheritance and to the promise. So she's saying, okay, it's time now for these kids to separate. Verse 11, the matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son, Ishmael. He loves Ishmael. But God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your maidservant. listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also, because he is your offspring." Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave him to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bow shot away, for she thought, "I cannot watch the boy die." Okay, this is told very quickly, but obviously they're in the wilderness, there's no water, and this is a life and death situation. And as she sat there nearby, she began to sob. Verse 17, this looks frightening. It looks very familiar to the scene we saw in chapter 16, right? God heard the boy crying, verse 17, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert and became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Haran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. Okay? Similar story. They have to leave the family, and God comforts them in the desert, provides for them, and says he's with the boys who's growing up. All right, final scene, chapter 25. This is the end of the story in Genesis of Isaac and Ishmael. Sarah dies in the meantime, and verse 1, Abraham takes another wife named Keturah, and he has kids through her. Verse 5, Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac. Verse 7, altogether, Abraham lived 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people. His sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre in the field of Ephron, son of... there Abraham was born with his wife Sarah. So the final scene of Isaac and Ishmael is them together burying their father. And then verse 12 through 18 gives us kind of an account of Ishmael's line. Verse 18, it says, his descendants settled in the area of the Havilah to Shur, near the border of Egypt, as you go toward Ashur. And then you have the same phrase as we had in chapter 16. And they lived to the east of their brothers, in the presence of their brothers. They lived in hostility toward all their brothers. Okay? Hard to say. So that's how the story ends. So whatever we make of the prophecy in chapter 16, what I've come to realize is this view of Ishmael that I had as a kid as a cursed line is clearly not true, right? I mean, nowhere do you get a sense of that. What you get is Isaac is the child of promise. It's him. It's him that God is going to make Abraham into a great nation and bless him. But Ishmael is a brother and a son of Abraham, and as such, he too has God's protection and blessing, but he is of a natural seed, and Isaac's of this supernatural seed that God is doing something special. Very different from blessed and cursed, at least the way I saw it. And again, whatever that prophecy says, you don't see that prophecy being played out that much in the history. I mean, they clearly have to separate. So there is hostility. I don't mean to say that's not the right interpretation, but you see God comforting, being with Ishmael, and then you see the two brothers back together at the death of their father, and you don't see this, you know, at least not open hostility, at least in the story of Genesis, okay? Agreed? Does that feel, we got a full picture? Okay, so now we're going to move on, and I got to move quick. I know I got to move quick. Here's our timeline. So we covered this. Let's look at, what does the rest of the Bible say about Ishmael and Isaac and their descendants? And I'll be pretty quick here. And my main point is going to be how little the rest of Scripture makes of this relationship, whether it's a hostile relationship or not. There's almost nothing in the rest of Scripture that talks specifically about the line of Ishmael and how the Jews and the Jewish nation do with them. And basically what you see is, especially when the Jews are faithful to God, and in the heyday of the Jewish nation, this is when, you know, the Jews come out of Egypt, and then they become a monarchy under King David and King Solomon. It's kind of the golden years. During that time, they have generally pretty good relationships with the Ishmaelites. So you've got like King David. A lot of the people in his armies were Ishmaelites. He brings in these foreigners to be part of his armies, and some of them are Ishmaelites. David's sister marries an Ishmaelite. And then, of course, you've got King Solomon, and you've got people from Ishmael's line coming to Jerusalem, bringing gifts. You have the Queen of Sheba. Remember the Queen of Sheba visits? She's an Ishmaelite. So you have generally some positive relationships. And then you also have some negative relationships, especially when Israel disobeys God and when the monarchy is divided into two. You do have some fighting going on between Ishmael's line and Isaac's line, the Jews and what we'll now call the Arabs. But mainly, can you see this? You can kind of see this? Israel comes out of Egypt, right? And they come through Sinai, and then they settle. This is the Promised Land, hard to see. This is a shot of the surrounding nations. You have like the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, all the ites in the Old Testament, right? The Philistines. Those are the main people that the Jews have a problem with in the Old Testament. Okay, these are not Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites are all over here. So the main struggles that we read about in Kings and things like that are with these nations, or the larger nations like the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonians. None of those are Ishmaelite people. So the rest of Scripture doesn't mention a ton about the Ishmaelites. Here's one verse in Psalm 83. It's talking about how the nations are conspiring against Israel, and the Ishmaelites are mentioned in this list of nations. With cunning, the nations conspire against your people. They plot against those you cherish. Come, they say, let us destroy them as a nation. With one mind, they plot together. They form an alliance against you. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, the tents of Moab and the Hagarites, Gebal, Ammon, and the Amalekite, Philistia. Okay, so they come in a list of people that are kind of fighting against the Jews, but not really in a way that sets them up as any different from any of the other nations. So what I learned is, you know, you've got something that happens in chapter 16 and what we read, and then Scripture kind of just, the story really basically disappears. We don't have any open hostility or really, really good relationships. That's kind of it. Some people suggest that the wise men, when they come to Jesus, those were actually Ishmaelites, but there's no proof of that. So there's not a lot that's said in the rest of Scripture about this relationship. Here's a promise that someday the Ishmaelites will come. We're not going to look at that. All right, so we're two down and two to go, okay? You're still good to go? Yeah? Okay, all right. I'm a pleaser, so. All right. Any basic questions about that, actually? I'll just stop for a second. Yeah. That's awesome. I don't play piano, and you don't want to hear my voice without anything else. Yeah, Les. Yeah, that's how I would read it. It is well, there's two ways of seeing it. Yes, I'd say from a human perspective, yes, that God had a plan for Abraham and Sarah, and it was a pretty radical plan. It required really radical faith. Like, you're 70, and you're not going to have kids. And I made this promise like 20 years ago, and it still hasn't happened. And they did what most people would do in their situation, but that was ultimately not part of the plan of faith. So I would say yes in that perspective. The other way of looking at it is God is, when we have a view of God's sovereignty that incorporates those things, that God is making, actually promised to make Abraham a father of many nations. And so this is part of the story of him making a father, not just of one nation, but of many nations. And that God incorporates, this decision into his plan. And so, yeah, I would say it that way. But at the same time, it's hard to know how negative. What's really interesting is you read the New Testament comments about Abraham and Sarah, and I'm trying to think of, this is either Galatians or Romans or Hebrews, but it talks about how Abraham like never wavered, never his faith held out. You're like, are you kidding me? Like, did you read Genesis 16? And either he's just given a really favorable view of him, or they just saw that a little bit less black and white than we did, given the cultural differences and the fact that God had never specifically said through Sarah, I'm going to give you seed, until after that. And I, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that's true. But it is curious to me that they never, no one ever makes note of his blunder, you know. And we look at it from our perspective and say, come on, you're not giving a full picture of this guy. So I don't know what to do with that, but I would still say yes to that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Huh. Yeah, great. Nothing to add. Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I read a book from a Lebanese Christian on this stuff, and so it was, you know, you've got a Ishmaelite who is a believer and teaching theology, you know, and it was great to, you know, it's just a picture of a person. Yeah. All right, I'll keep going. Oh yeah, there. Yeah, so Jacob and Esau, we've got Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac has Jacob and Esau, right? And Esau is, his descendants are the Edomites. And that actually, there's a lot more hostility between the Jews and the Edomites. Though there's not a lot of prophecy, I don't think, that actually predicts some. Well, no, it does, of course. What am I thinking? Yes. Right before they're born, actually. Yeah, so that's actually, biblically, there's a lot more hostility between the descendants of Jacob and Esau than Isaac and Ishmael. I was going to say one other thing. Obadiah, the book of Obadiah, minor prophet. The whole thing is dedicated to cursing the Edomites. It's not a pleasant book, but yeah. Okay, let's keep going because we got more to go. All right, so we've got where it started, we've got the rest of Christian history, or biblical history, and then let's look at history from 1880, or from Christ to 1880, basically. Okay, so so funny, I've been spending a lot of time preparing for this, and I'm thinking about all these things, and none of you probably are thinking about any of this stuff. I mean, you're just walking into this, you're like, what is this? I'm like, what if they ask this? What if they ask this? Like, you know, they may not even think about this stuff. But, okay. So before we go into that, just two distinctions that we want to clarify that might be really obvious. But, you know, we're leading into this Arab-Israeli conflict that we see today in the Middle East. So we look at that, and we just read that back into Scripture, basically. And that might be the right move to make. But so you've got Jews and Arabs fighting, and we go, oh, look, that's Isaac and Ishmael, okay? Just two things I want to say. This keeps catching. Just a reminder, not all Arabs are Ishmaelites, okay? So, you know, Arab people are, they speak Arabic, they're generally nomadic, but, you know, Ishmaelites are part of what makes up the overall Arab people, but, you know, the term Arab is much broader than Ishmaelite. And reality is today, we probably don't really know who are Ishmaelites and who are other, you know, we just group them into Arab, okay? But so Ishmael is not going to include all of those. It would be a subgroup of that we probably can't clearly define. The other, even more important thing to realize that you all know, but just to say it, is that not all Muslims are Arab, okay? Which is an important thing, okay? Islam is a religion, right? When we say Arab, we're talking about an ethnic group. And obviously there's a lot of intersection between those, but not all Muslims are Arab. That's important. Here's a map. It's not very clear. This is a map of the Arab world, okay? So some of these people are going to be Ishmaelites, especially people in this area. You've got, here's Israel, you've got Syria, Iraq, you know, you've got, you know, Arabian Peninsula, and then a lot of northern Africa, okay? This is a map of the Arab world. Notice places that are not included, okay? What is this right here? Anybody know what that is? That country? That's Iran, okay? Iran is not an Arab country, okay? They're not Arabs. They're Indo-European. They don't speak Arabic. They speak Farsi. So if you told them, a person from Iran that they're Arab, I think that they would take offense, okay? They're Muslim, though, right? So they're united by religion, but they're not united by ethnicity. So Pakistan, Afghanistan, a lot of Muslim people, but those are not Arabs. We kind of group those all together, right? If you're kind of in a hot, dry climate, you're Arab. And that's not true. So when we look at what Iran is doing, for instance, and they're trying to build nuclear, you know, who's the president? I can't pronounce his name. Thank you. Okay, excuse you. Okay, so that's not an Ishmaelite. Okay, that's a Muslim, Indo-European who lives in Iran. Okay, so we're going to have to make a distinction between them and people in Saudi Arabia. So Osama bin Laden is from Saudi Arabia, so he could be an Ishmaelite. Okay, Saddam is from Iraq, so he's an Arab. Okay, those are Arabs that might be Ishmaelites. Okay, so just a little distinction that we want to keep clarification. So that's Arab. So that's an ethnic, yeah. And of course, here's what we think of. When we think of Arabs, we think of Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, this area. But apparently, they spread over the centuries in through northern Africa. And again, you know, you got all sorts of people living here. But these are the strongly Arab nations. Okay. When we're looking at what Iran is doing with their nuclear war plans, we don't want to read that back into Isaac and Ishmael, because he's actually not an Ishmaelite, okay? So, just clarification. Yeah, please. And I might not know your answers, because I'm just learning. Please. Yes. So biblically, I had a cool little, Tara, you'd have liked this, I had a cool genogram. Biblically speaking, if we're just looking at the biblical data, the Arabs, there's three different genealogical lists that they would trace their descendants from. So I wanted to bring this, but I thought it'd be way too much information, so here it is. So the flood happens. This is well before Abraham. Flood happens. Noah has three sons. One of the sons is Shem, right? And that's where we get the Shemites or the Semites. So people now are anti-Semites. They are anti-descendants of Shem, which includes Jewish people. About four generations after Shem, there's two brothers. And one of the brothers' lines is traced to Abraham, okay? And then we get Isaac and Ishmael. And the other brother's line is where a lot of Arabs take their kind of descendants from. So that's one group. The other group is obviously Ishmael himself. And the other one is, remember when I mentioned that Abraham had a third wife, Keturah? Her descendants, the Arabs trace also. And there's different, like, one of those groups is like the northern Arabs, one of those groups is the central Arabs, and one of those groups is like the southern Arabs, and then they migrate. So there's, at least in terms of the biblical data, that's where this Lebanese Christian guy, at least in the book that I read, that's where he said those three groups, at least from a biblical account, comprise the Arab nation. And I'm sure they have no idea where they come from now, you know. It's like, where do I come from? So I'm guessing it was more, it was ethnicity, it was lifestyle, and language would be my guess. And then, which we'll see in 600 years after Christ, then you get Islam, and then that there's a religious thing that unites them. Yeah. So. What is it? One of them is, I read two books. What is it? It's Arabs. I think it's Arabs in the Shadow of Israel. And the other one was, Whose Land Is It Anyways? Talking about Palestine and whose land is it. So we're looking at, remember, we're looking at time of Christ to 1880s. Again, what I, at least in the reading that I've done, what I was surprised to find is that it's a relatively peaceful existence between Jews and Arabs. okay? There is some conflict. There's not a lot more conflict with them than with anybody else. Certainly the Jews have had a lot more conflict with Christians than with Arabs, at least from 0 to 1880. Okay, so here's, we're just going to run down some really random things for you. So here's the Arabs, give you a little history of what happened to them. 400 BC to about 180, there was an Arab kingdom called the Nabataean Kingdom. It would have been in Saudi Arabia, that area, really strong, powerful empire. Their capital was Petra. Who's been to Petra? Been to Petra? Awesome site. My mom and I have been to Petra. 180, the Romans kind of defeat them, and from 100 to 600, they're under Roman, the Roman Empire takes over. They're under, so Arabs are living under the Roman Empire. In terms of the Jews, big events, obviously, at the time of Christ, they're living in the land of Palestine, the land of Israel, whatever we want to call it. Same thing, Palestine, Israel. I'm using those terms synonymously. The big event is 70 AD. The Romans come in and destroy the temple, basically destroy Jerusalem. And that really changes Judaism as we know it. And then the other big one was about 60 years later, there's a Jewish revolt again in Israel, and the Romans again come in and just wipe them out. And that's pretty much, after that, the Jews, you know, Jesus' time, you've got Jews, they're not in control of their land, but there's a lot of Jews living there. After 132, Jews are basically scattered, they're minority groups throughout the Roman Empire. Okay, so I'm just giving you big world history events. 330 AD, so you got the Roman Empire, hugely significant moment in the world. The emperor at the time, Constantine, becomes a Christian. And the Roman Empire becomes, it's a Byzantine Empire, it becomes a Christian empire. And Christianity becomes the official state religion, basically. So Christians go from being this persecuted minority to being, you know, the majority. And there's obviously pressure to, you know, commit to that. Okay, so 600, about 600 is where you get the rise of Islam. Okay, so you've got this area here. And the Roman Empire is on the decline. They've been living under Roman rule, and basically conditions in this area are kind of ripe for a new religion. Just put it that way. There's kind of anarchy, it's a tough time, and they're just ripe for something new. Christianity never really catches on in this area. So you've got, where am I here? Oh, so 570, a guy named Muhammad is born here in Mecca, right around there. I put that dot on the map. It's close enough. And supposedly, he encounters the angel Gabriel, who gives him this new vision of, you know, what God is doing. And his early message is basically, he's calling the people in this area back to the one God, the God of Abraham, the God of the Christians, the God of the Israelites, basically. And he meets some success and some not success. And increasingly, his message gets more political and more violent, okay? So first he's preaching, and then he starts trying to gain power over time. And he begins to gain power. There's one event I read about that was in 622, where there are some, you know, there's Jewish people living in this area at the time. There's a couple Jewish groups and some Arab groups, and they bring Muhammad in to kind of arbitrate some conversations they're having, and this ends with two of the Jewish groups being kicked out of the place, and then one group, about like 900 people, are beheaded, basically. And so that's what happens there. And he basically begins a series of military campaigns, as far as I understand it. I don't really know the details of Muhammad's life. But Islam begins to expand its territory, and it begins to kind of push out pagan Arabs and Jews, people who aren't converting to Islam. And so by 630, Mecca is purified of paganism, and that becomes the capital of this new religion. And Muhammad dies in 632, and by that time, most of the Arabian Peninsula is under Islamic rule, basically, by the end of his life. So the start of Islam has some violent aspects to it, at least as I understand the history of Muhammad himself. So it starts that way. So this is the start of a new religion. And most of you know you've got the Quran that Muhammad's responsible for. And the Quran gives a higher place to Ishmael than it does to Isaac. And Ishmael is only mentioned like 12 verses actually in the Quran, and most of them are just in lists of holy men of the past. But basically they say that Ishmael was the one who was going to be sacrificed, not Isaac. So this whole idea of Isaac is the child of promise and Ishmael's not, I think it's basically reversed more or less in Islam. Okay, let's see what I've got here. All right, so 630 to 1100, so Jerusalem even, Islam spreads. And for this time, even the Holy Land itself, Jerusalem is under Muslim rule. I'm going to keep moving. 1100 to 1300, time of history I'm not particularly proud of as a Christian, but the Crusades, people coming from England and from Europe come in to try to recapture, and they do recapture Jerusalem, and there's all out war with the Muslims. And about 1300, the Muslims regain control. The 1500, and then 1500 to World War I, you have the Ottoman Empire, which comes in, which is Turkish in descent, and takes over. Here's a little picture of the Ottoman Empire. It's kind of rule in 1580. So here's the Promised Land right here, Mediterranean Sea. So they kind of take over up until World War I. Okay, so that is sort of the history up to 1880. What you've got throughout this time is you have Jews that are just kind of scattered throughout Arab territory. Yeah. What you actually find, you definitely have some violent conflict at different times, especially at the beginning. But in my reading, I was surprised that even through this time, that Jews enjoyed relative peace in Arab areas. Islam spread in a political and military way, but once they'd kind of taken over places, particularly Jews would experience a degree of protection because they were still people of the book. They were monotheists, Muslims. They don't have a lot of pagan practices or the foods they eat, so it's not as bad as like the Christians. And the Jews don't represent a threat to Islam. It's not a political threat like Christianity was, because Christianity is you've got this huge Christian empire. And so the Jews are just scattered people, and they don't represent a military threat. So they actually enjoy relative peace in these areas. But they are, as I understand it, more or less second-class citizens. They're not, I mean, they have to pay like extra taxes. So it's not like ideal. But there's not a ton of just direct hostility, any more than there would be with other groups, especially compared to the Christians. The Jews experience much more persecution from the Christians. You've got the Spanish Inquisition. You have all sorts of things where Jews are being forced to convert to Christianity and killed for not doing so, which is another wonderful part of our history. But basically, my reading at least, and again, this is so surface, my understanding is so surface, but is the rest of the Bible doesn't make that big a deal of it. And even history up to 1880, there's not, if you knew nothing, you wouldn't think, whoa, these two groups are really going at it any more than other groups are going at it. At least as I understand it. Now that changes dramatically 1880 to the present. So here we are. We just covered this, and this is our final place here. 1880 to the present. I want to ask in this section, I'll talk it through, and then I want to ask those questions again. Who's at fault? Same questions I asked in Genesis. Who's to blame? And then finally, what is God's stance towards all this? How does God feel about this stuff? Especially, how does God feel about the Jews in this situation? This recent time of history, what has started this whole thing is the Zionist movement. You guys know, when I use Zionism, it's a movement to help the Jews come back onto the land that God promised to them in the Old Testament, okay? It's that issue of Jews moving from scattered places in Europe especially and migrating to Israel. We'll talk about why that happened. But that is what has sparked the conflict that really for thousands of years didn't really exist in any extreme way. So I want to give you just brief historical stuff on this. quick, just little stat. The land of Israel at 1880, total population at this time is 480,000 people. Arabs make up 95% of the population. Jews make up 5%, okay? The Ottoman Empire is ruling, okay? So there's no nation of Palestine or Syria or Jordan. This is just all part of the Ottoman Empire, okay? So there's just generally Arabs and some Jews living scattered throughout this place with no actual nations, because the nations don't come into existence until this century. Yeah. Oh, I assume they're Muslim, primarily. That's a good question. I'm assuming primarily Muslim. I mean, they're either going to be Muslim or Christian, and I don't think they're Christian. So I'm assuming Muslim. So they're united by religion, but not by ethnicity, would be, right? Okay, so here's our timeline. So here's what happens. Throughout the 1800s, you have anti-Semitism happening in Europe, okay? Anti-Semitism, right? Now, technically, Arabs are Semites, right? Because they come from Shem. But when we use anti-Semitism today, we mean anti-Jew. So what you have, and most of us know this story, you've got just a lot of anti-Jewish feeling throughout the centuries, since the first century, really, and especially going on in Europe, in Christian and atheist nations in Europe, particularly Russia. This is really extreme. So Jews are just, they're the scapegoat, basically, of nations. They're being blamed for all sorts of things. You have the pogroms, these riots, kind of these violent acts against Jews. It's just, yeah. I don't know. I assume it stems from, ultimately, from the New Testament, from the Jewish, basically the primary Jewish rejection of Jesus in the first century, that the majority of Jews do not accept Jesus as Messiah, and then Europe becomes Christianized, and so this is our religion, and you are the people who didn't accept him, and oh yeah, and you killed him, you know, that's kind of the sentiment. I assume it kind of starts from that, but it's a great question. I don't totally know. And they become like scapegoats for all sorts of things. Like, there was a fire, must have been the Jews. You know, if you're political, you just blame the Jews, basically, in Europe at the time. And it's just really sad. I mean, these people are, you know, they're scattered and they're persecuted, and it's awful. So there's this growing sentiment that starts around then that, you know what? You know what would be great? If the Jews had a place of their own. You know, just somewhere that would be a haven for them. Because wherever they go, they just kind of experience this anti-Semitism. So there's this growing sentiment. So 1896, Theodor Herzl, he's a Hungarian Jew, he writes a book called The Jewish State. And he starts taking this sentiment and mounting it into a political movement, saying the Jews need a land of their own. And different places are actually suggested, like Argentina was one of the places that they suggested. But the most logical one, of course, is Israel. I mean, Palestine, right? This is the land of their descendants, their forefathers. So this becomes more of a political thing. So so what starts happening, really between 1880 and World War I, Jews start fleeing persecution in Europe, and they start acquiring land in Palestine. And you've got Jews that have a little bit more money and are kind of more organized. You've got the land of Israel. You've got these landowners who, a lot of them, are absentee landowners. They don't even live in the land. They're wealthy. So they just start selling land to Jews, okay? And then you've also got the Arabs who are actually living there. And what starts to happen is Jews begin to, you know, come and begin to take, you know, just acquire land over time. And as that happens, you start to have some conflict. Because some of the Arab people are poor, and they can't, you know, they're renting out their land at high interest, and the Jews are coming in, and you start getting some tension happening even back then. Okay, so here's what happened. World War I, what happens is nations like Britain make contradictory promises to the Jews and to the Arabs in Palestine. So to the Arabs in Palestine, they say, you know, we're going to help you. If you help us defeat the Ottoman Empire, we will give you a land when this is all said and done. You will gain a land with independence. And meanwhile, they're saying to the Jews in Europe, if you help us, you know, we're going to help you establish this land. That's my understanding. That might not be, I'm sure, you know, England has a different story on it than that. But as I understand it, so both groups start to gain this sense of maybe there's a possibility of nationalism that could, you know, this that they never really had before. So after World War I, So World War I takes place. The League of Nations basically gives the land of Palestine over to England. And this is a significant event. The Balfour Declaration, I think Balfour was the Prime Minister of England, 1970, they talk about establishing a national homeland for the Jewish people. Not actually talking about necessarily a nation, but a place where Jews and Arabs will coexist in the land of Palestine. Not sure exactly how they expect that's going to work. But what you have is the plan was for large migration of Jewish people into the area of Palestine, and still protection for the Palestinian Arabs that are there. That's the way the plan is supposed to work. So Jews continue to migrate from England, from Europe. So you've just got a lot of Jewish immigration up till World War II. And as more Jews come in, you have more clashes with the people that were there before them. They're gathering up land. People are getting nervous. Things are starting to get a little bit more tense. All right. Biggest event is World War II, and leading up to that, the Holocaust, okay, in Nazi Germany, where you have 6 million Jews, virtually, who are killed by the Nazis. And that event just, you know, sparks a international sympathy and heart for the Jewish people who've just been, you know, utterly crushed and just utterly persecuted, and this worldwide sentiment that the Jews need a land of their own, a land to call their own, a land where they can be safe and no longer experience this. So 1947, just to give you, here's the land of Palestine. At this point, Arabs now make up 70% of the population. And the Jews make up 30%. They own 6% of the land. 1947, after World War II ends, the United Nations takes over the land of Palestine, and they come up with a two-state plan in this land. They say, we're going to divide the land in certain ways, and we're going to set up a Palestinian state for Palestinian Arabs, and we're going to set up a Jewish state, okay? And I think the Jews get about 55% of the land, Arabs get about 45% of the land. And the Jews accept this plan, and the Arabs reject it, okay? And I'm guessing that today, if they could go back, they would accept it, from what I know. But they reject the plan. And again, the world is, there's this unbelievable sympathy for the Jews. So this is a worldwide commitment to the United Nations. We need to do this. And the Palestinians are like, hey, I understand, but it's not our fault that Jews were exterminated in Nazi Christian Germany, and then you're gonna take over our land. So I'm trying to kind of understand, because we, at least I grew up understanding the Jewish, you know, view, and so I'm trying to help myself have sympathy for the Palestinian view. Here's two quotes I'm gonna give you. The Christian West was able to escape in large measure from its accumulated centuries of anti-Semitic guilt by helping displaced Jews find refuge in a predominantly Arab land. With the partition plan, the Palestinian Arabs saw themselves being forced to give up much of their lands as a part of a grand-scale international effort at restitution and compensation to the Jews. The Palestinians concluded that they were being required to pay for the anti-Semitic sins of the Christian West. One more. Someone said, there is no example in history of a people saying, we agreed to renounce our country, let another come and settle here and outnumber us. again, the question is, whose fault is this that we're asking? And you just, the more I read, the more I have such sympathy for both sides. It's very easy to have sympathy for the Jews in terms of what has taken place for them. And it's, as you hear just the details, you feel for these Palestinian Arabs who are basically required to leave, a lot of them leave their homes, leave their land to do this international thing that was happening because Western people persecuted Jews, basically. So there's the two-state plan. Israel accepts it. Palestine refuses. 1948, the state of Israel is actually declared again. You have tons of Jews coming into this area, and they declare statehood. The Arabs all over reject, don't even acknowledge it, and immediately there's a war. And Arab forces from all the surrounding places attack the Jews from Jordan, from Syria, from Lebanon, I think from Egypt, and they're defeated. And we're going to see that as a common theme. You have wars, and the Jews win every time, basically. So what happens after that war, the Jews, because of that war, the Jews take over large portions now of Israel, that even more than they would have had under the two-state plan. About 700,000 Palestinian Arabs are driven from their homes. They settle in surrounding countries, or they get stuck in what will be called occupied territories in Israel. So there's this war is kind of, there's a clearing of the land that takes place because of this war. The Jews have statehood, and they have much more control. 1967, I'm going to move quickly through the rest of this. You've got the Six-Day War. Egypt attacks, and Israel wins. They take large parts of the Sinai in the south. And throughout, a lot of times, the Jews are asked to give up the land that they gained through the wars, and oftentimes they do, which, you know, people don't usually give up, you know, land they win in wars. That's whatever. But they do. 1973, the Yom Kippur War, again with Egypt. So these are Arabs in the south. Israel wins. 1878, 1982, Israel invades Lebanon, trying to protect its borders. It's pretty successful. And then you have 1987 through 1993, you've got what's called intifadas, or these uprisings. So here's what you've got. Here's the land of Israel now. Obviously, you've got Arab nations around it. And here's Israel. And now, many of you know way more about this than I do. But you know that we've got, what's this right here? Does anybody know this? That's the West Bank. Okay, so you got two areas that look kind of Arab in color, right? These are what we could call occupied territories. So this is the West Bank, and this is the Gaza Strip. So whenever you open your newspapers, you hear West Bank and Gaza Strip. So this is primarily where the Palestinian Arabs now live. This is all, you know, within the borders of Israel. But these are the occupied territories, occupied because they're being occupied by Jews, even though a lot of Arabs live there, Palestinian Arabs live there. So these intifadas that I just mentioned are, you've got these uprisings in these areas where you've got, you know, these Arabs who are basically fighting and starting riots or whatever in reaction to the Jewish occupation. And generally the UN has asked the Israelites to remove themselves, their military presence from these areas. And generally Israel has not. And again, you can understand why. They're trying to protect themselves. It's understandable why they haven't removed their military presence. So I've kind of skipped a million things. But basically, that's where you have it today, is you've got, I'm trying to remember how many, maybe about, I'm not sure what the stats are, but you've got, obviously you have Arabs living in Israel proper, and you have a huge concentration of them in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip. You have a military presence, Israeli military presence there, and basically what you have is you've got, you know, Israel has just superior firepower. I mean, they have the backing of the U.S. military, so they always win wars. And then you have these Arab nations around, and these people in the middle that, so Israel kind of fights, we would say, you know, kind of fights fair more. It's kind of organized, it's a military operation, it's targeted, and they have the military power, even though they don't have the numbers, the physical numbers. And then you've got the Palestinians, who are kind of these rogue, you know, the way they fight are these kind of terrorist rogue attacks. You just have some Palestinian kid who grew up in occupied territory, and he, you know, straps a bomb to himself and he drives into his civilian place, and that's how they fight these wars. And so you've got, that's kind of the situation that you have today. So I wanted to go back to this map here, this Arab map, and just to kind of sum this up of what's happened in the last 120 years. I mean, you've got all this green, and you've got this little red patch right in the middle. You've got Israel right in the heart of the Arab world, and then right in the larger heart of the Muslim world. So what you have these now, you have hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs basically living in refugee camps, whether in the occupied territories or even as they moved into other countries in horrible conditions, a lot of them. Some of them have assimilated, but some of them not. And then you've got millions of Jews living in constant fear, right? Because they're in the middle of this Arab world that hates them. Both of them have ancient claims to the land, right? The Jews basically lived on the land from 2000 to the time of Christ. The Arabs basically lived on the land from the time of Muhammad, 600 to about, you know, about 1300 years, basically. You've had four major wars over the last 50 years. So it's a pretty messy situation. So my two questions, as it applies to this last part, first one is, whose fault is this? Who's to blame? What I've come to, at least, is that I definitely have a mutual sympathy for both groups. And when I'm talking about the Palestinian Arabs, not just the surrounding Arabs, but those Arabs, especially in Palestine, that gave up their land. And, of course, sympathy for the Jews for all that they've been through. And at the same time, both have made a lot of mistakes in their treatment of one another. And that's, anyone who knows the history knows that's true. And the sad reality is, I think, in terms of who's to blame, a lot of it is honestly Christian Europe. I mean, it's the anti-Semitism in the turn of the century in Russia and other, and of course Germany, that basically sparks this movement, that creates this tension. And to me, the great irony is the Jews migrated to Israel to escape persecution, and now they're in the midst of, you know, such intense persecution. My reading is there is some ancient hostility between these groups that go way back, but most of it is what has taken place in the last 130 years. That's where, before that, whether it's biblical time or before history, you don't see that much stuff going on when you compare it to other groups and their fighting. One last question. The question I asked at the beginning: how does God feel about this? What is God's stance in this, especially in this modern situation? Especially, what is God's stance towards Israel as a state and what's going on in the Middle East? What's his position? And I'm not going to answer this question because I don't know the answer. But I want to point you to two different positions. It all depends on your view of certain things. And there are two basic theologies that have different answers to what God's stance is in the Middle East right now. And you are one of these two, whether you know it or not, probably. One is dispensational, and one is what I'll call covenant theology. So I'm going to give you just a five-minute rundown on these two things. Okay, here's what they both agree on. First, they both agree that God promised the land to the Jews in the Old Testament, right? Here's the promise. This is Genesis 17:8, God promising to Abraham, the whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give you, listen to this, as an everlasting possession, calls it their inheritance in other places, to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. I'm going to give you this land as an everlasting possession. Both agree that God had always promised the Jews in the Old Testament, if you disobey me, you will get kicked off of this land, okay? This is Leviticus 18:28. If you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you. And you know the story, most of you know, that the Jews, after King David and Solomon, you know, they went into exile. Other nations came and conquered them. They went into exile. Both theologies obviously agree that God promised a return from exile. God said, I'm going to gather you from the nations, and I will bring you back to the promised land. This is Ezekiel 11:17. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I will gather you from the nations and bring you back from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you back the land of Israel again. Okay, both theologies agree on that. Now, here's the issue. God promises this return from exile, and those of you that know your Old Testament know that the Jews did come back. They did return from exile, right? And they came back to the land, And so at the time of Christ, Israel is on the land. But the issue is this: that return did not live up to expectations, okay? It didn't live up to all the promises that God made about that return. So I won't go into these promises, but we'll take Ezekiel. Ezekiel talks about this great return and the cleansing of hearts and this peace that's going to take place. And then Ezekiel sees this new temple that's going to be built, right? And God goes around and measures off the dimensions of this new temple. And then God also shows him, here's how the land is going to be divided among the 12 tribes. And it charts out this, you know, the scope of what Israel will be physically in the temple and all of that. And the return from exile never lived up to those things, okay? There's a lot of promises that God made, if you take them a certain way, that were left unfulfilled. They come back, but the Romans are in control, and they own only a part of Israel and all that. So here's the issue. What do you do? Are you guys still with me? You hanging in? Okay, good. Okay. The issue is, what do you do with that unmet expectation? What do you do with those promises that haven't been fulfilled according to the way they're described, like in Ezekiel, a million other places in the Old Testament? And here's where the theologies change. Dispensational theology makes two basic assumptions, okay? It's this. It expects a literal earthly fulfillment of those Old Testament promises to the Jews. These are the two basic assumptions. If you just know this, you know dispensational theology, okay? A literal earthly fulfillment of those Old Testament promises to the Jews. And it also assumes that God still has two distinct plans in history. One for, that should say the church, actually. One for the church and one for Jewish ethnic people. Those are the two underlying assumptions of dispensational theology. So here it is. Basically, a lot of those Old Testament prophecies weren't totally fulfilled. So what we can expect is one day they are going to be filled, literally, right? So the Jews are going to, at some point, come back on land, and this temple that Ezekiel describes will be present, and this division of land will happen. They will own the land as it says. His promises are irrevocable. God never changes. God fulfills his promises. And so what we can expect is, since some of these things haven't been fulfilled, one day in the future, they will be fulfilled for physical Jewish ethnic descendants in the land of Israel. Okay? That's the assumption. So the implications of that are these. Jews have a divine right to the land today. The modern return to the land is the fulfillment of Old Testament promises. What we are seeing in our generation, or actually your parents' generation, that was a fulfillment of promises made thousands of years ago. And so it's hugely significant. Number three, the establishment of the state of Israel is key in Christ's return. Okay, this is the establishment of Israel is leading up to the return of Christ. And therefore, Christians should support the idea of a Jewish state and defend it, which is what America has done and what a lot of Christian America has done. So dispensational theology made popular by Hal Lindsey, right? Late Great Planet Earth, and then more commonly today in the Left Behind series. Okay, that's dispensational theology. That is the theology that most of us probably have or grew up in if we are Southern California evangelical Christians. So again, the idea is, the Jews are back on the land. There's going to be a rapture of the Christians, right? And then Christ is going to return. And all those Old Testament prophecies are finally going to be fulfilled in the millennium, where Christ establishes this earthly kingdom, and the Jews experience all of those promises because they haven't been fulfilled yet, okay? So God, if that's your theology, God has a particular view on this. The other one is the covenant theology, and it makes two opposite basic assumptions, and it's this. The first one is that the Old Testament promises are not going to be filled literally and earthly, but they are fulfilled in the ministry of Jesus, maybe we could say a spiritual way. So they're actually, all those promises are in some way fulfilled in Jesus Christ, or they will be ultimately fulfilled, not in an earthly way, but in the new heavens and the new earth, a la Revelation 21 and 22, when the new Jerusalem comes down, and, you know, that when all is made new and God recreates everything. That is where you see the final fulfillment. But before then, we're not going to see an earthly fulfillment that has any significance theologically. The other assumption is God has only one plan for Jew and Gentile. God is now, at the coming of Christ, God is basically about followers of Christ, whether they're Jew or Gentile. The Gentiles have been grafted in to the Jewish vine, And now there's only one plan. There's not a distinct plan for Christians who are going to be raptured while Jews are down here. It's all about God's people, Jew and Gentile, followers of Christ. That's the assumption. And again, you know, both theologies would agree with parts of the others. It's a matter of emphasis. Of course, dispensationalists would say, well, yeah, God has a plan for one people, but it's about emphasis. So if that's what you think, then the implications are this. It's the church, Jewish and Gentile believers, basically, the land of Israel is not significant. The role of the church now is just to spread the gospel throughout the four corners of the earth. And covenant theologians would say the New Testament makes almost no statements about the land of Israel. I mean, virtually nothing. Instead, that words like inheritance, promises of God, are now applied to eternal inheritance, to an eternal New Jerusalem in heaven. So that would mean that Jewish ownership of the land of Canaan, or land of Palestine, is no longer significant. Christians have no inherent obligation to support or deny, it's not the right word, but deny a Jewish state. Basically, this view would say what's happening now is actually, it's not really significant from a theological perspective. This is not a fulfillment of God's promise to the Jews, because that's been fulfilled in the church, and it will be fulfilled in the new heavens and the new earth. Let me just see what I want to say here. Okay, yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's basically the church age is kind of a parenthesis in God's plan, and at the end of that, he's going to pick up with the Jews again and do some radical things with them. So Romans 9 through 11 talks about this time of hardening of the Jews, but then until the time of the Gentiles were fulfilled, and then all Israel will be saved. So Paul's making a long argument there, but what he's saying is people are wondering, if Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, why have so many Jews rejected him? And Paul's saying, hey, God hasn't rejected his people, the Jews. For one, he's saying, I'm a Jew, and I'm a Christian, and God can bring his people back. And he seems to say some things that make it sound like maybe one day there's going to be a big coming to Christ of the Jewish people. Now, he says nothing in that about the land or a nation. There's nothing in there about that. But there's certainly a way of reading that you could say there's going to be a future time where a lot of Jews, if not all the Jews that are living at that time, will be converted to Christ. Is one place where they would find that. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, I think that's what a covenant person from perspective would argue, that is they say, you know, so many people, they lay claim to the Jewish right to have the land. But if you're going to do that, you have to hold to all that Scripture talks about how you're supposed to live in the land. That you have to, you know, there's to be justice. That you're to take care of the alien among you. And so they would say, you know, you can't go about this in the way that you're going about it. Because if you're going to hold that this is a fulfillment of Old Testament, you need to live by the Old Testament, which talks about how, you know, that is an argument that they would make. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, it's hard, you know, if you just kind of say, I believe in God's sovereignty, but how do I live? You know, you're still going to do things, and you're still going to say, I'm going to be intentional, I'm going to plan, I'm going to think, I'm going to act, you know, so I think arguments could be made on both sides, and people in the dispensational camp would say, I mean, just look at what's happened in the last, I mean, this is remarkable historical things that have taken place in the last 100 years, that a group of people have been, a nation has been created, and a group of people have just been taken from the four corners of the earth and established. How incredibly significant is that? How can this not be the act of God? You know, it would be the other argument. So, is it 11? Wow. Okay, that's an hour and a half. Wow. Okay. I was like, I have 11:30 lunch. Am I late or no? Okay. So I think I'm done. I haven't left you with anything, have I? Do you want to know where I lean? You probably know where I lean. Okay, it's probably obvious. I lean towards this one here. My reading of the New Testament takes me way closer to that than the dispensational view, but I grew up with most people who believe in the dispensational view. I would say most people, I don't know, I'd say if you polled this church, most people would be dispensational. Without knowing it, maybe, the label, you know. So I would probably be in the minority. I would definitely be in the minority in Southern California, evangelical Christianity. So it's a tough one. Smart people. To cap this off, I would say, you know, I remember being in Israel, and when I was in college, and we had a Jewish guy who, we were there for 3 weeks, and a Jewish guy was teaching us, and we just asked him, you know, what do we do? And he said pray for the peace of Jerusalem. That was his thing. He lived in the old city of Jerusalem. He said pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and you've got Psalms like Psalm 125, Psalm 128, talk about peace be on Israel. And I think ultimately, at least as a American person observing this, I think that should be our posture, personally, that we pray for those things that the prophets talk about justice and mercy and peace. And ultimately, you know, God established this people on earth through Abraham, and however you understand that now, that was to be blessed in order to be a blessing to the world. And so I think that's our role, is that we've been blessed in order to go out and bless the nations and try to point them and be salt and light. And so that would be my kind of my posture in this thing. But I recognize it's my own deal. So I think I'll leave it with that. Well, you hung in there. You did well. Thank you. I know that was really long. How do we end this? You're welcome. Sure. Pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks. You're welcome. Thank you. Great to be with you guys.